You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast featuring some of Indiana's most fascinating men and women whose impact has shaped our state, our communities, and us. Join us as we discuss their imprint on our history. Leaders and Legends is brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated, your local veteran business enterprise specializing in public relations, media relations, public outreach, crisis communications, and digital photography. My name is Robert Vane, Principal of Veteran Strategies, former Deputy Chief of Staff to Mayor Greg Ballard, and Communications Director for the Indiana Republican Party. I'm honored to be your host for our discussion. Thank you, everyone, for joining Leaders and Legends today. We are with a true legend of the Indianapolis sports community and media community, Bill Benner, a sports writer for The Star over about five decades almost.
Well, between The Star and the Indianapolis Business Journal, 45 years of covering sports in Indy.
Also Inside Indiana Business.
Yep, still.
And one of the absolute best guys you'll ever meet, frequent lunch partner. And as I told him one time, I used to read all your columns and go, why did you hate Bobby Knight? Just like I'd read Mark Allen's columns in The Star and go, why do you hate Van Halen? But once you sit down and talk to him, I'm telling you, you're going to enjoy the next 40, 45 minutes with Bill. Bill, thank you for joining us.
You bet. Glad to be here. And I hope I haven't dumbed down the term legend just by...
Oh, absolutely not. You're, and I'll say this, you are absolutely, since we're on the record, one of the most liked people I've ever met.
Well, thank you.
I cannot tell you the number of people who, when I say I'm having lunch with Bill Benner or had lunch with Bill Benner, like, ooh, I bet that was fun.
Well, I'm blessed just to have been in this town and for a long time. And I've had a number of, you know, funny thing, after I left The Star, and then it was Sports Corp, Visit Indy, Horizon League, and now Pacers, that enables you to really broaden your circles. And so I've been fortunate to have so many contacts and relationships with people over the years. It's been wonderful.
Is it more fun to look back on all the things that you've written about and all the people you've met than to look back and go, wow, where'd the time go? Like, when you look back at the breadth of what you've done and the depth of it, you're just like, what a great life.
It has been a great life, and I had so many incredible experiences when I was with the Indianapolis Star. You know, at a very young age, I got to be the beat writer for the Pacers the year in 1974 when they moved into Market Square Arena. You know, and later as a columnist, I covered three Olympic games, two Pan American games, got to travel the world, got to see and do incredible things all around the country. Yeah, I kind of look back at that and go, where did the time go? But at the same time, it's been just this incredible, incredible journey filled with experiences, watching remarkable people do remarkable things, and then to try and capsulize that in 750 or 1,000 words the next day in the Indianapolis Star. After I left the Star, the Indianapolis Business Journal was gracious enough to allow me to continue offering perspectives on sports, and I did that until 2013 when I joined Pacers Sports and Entertainment. So to have that kind of perspective, to watch how all this has evolved, because I've always had, you know, I grew up in what's now Lilly, the first 5 years of my life on Southeast Street. And then we moved to the country, Center Grove. But I was always an Indy guy, always loved Indianapolis and everything about it. But I shared the Indy inferiority complex, you know, that we richly deserve.
And you graduated from Center Grove in
67.
67.
67.
Then immediately went to IU.
Well, you know, this is where
Or you were in the military.
Well, what happened? A couple things. This is where a hurdle turned into an opportunity. Coming out of Center Grove, we did not have money, and so I was going to have to work my way through college. And what was then the IU extension, now IUPUI, the IU extension was three little repurposed office buildings over at one on North Meridian and one on Michigan Street in Delaware, and the other one on Delaware across the street on Michigan. And so I had to go to the IU extension to begin my career. But I got a job at the Indianapolis Star answering the score phones, 633-1200. Way before,
that's right, I remember that.
Way before you had computers and everything that you could instantly find a score, and people called this number to find out scores and have bets settled. But that got me, that got my foot in the door at the Indianapolis Star. And so after a year of being a score boy, I then got to know Bob Collins and Bob Williams and Harrison Howard and Cy McBride and John Banch, all the legends that I'd grown up reading.
Right.
And I had enough moxie to say, I want to do what you guys do. And at the time, it would be an intern now, but Cy McBride said, well, you can come work for us in the summertime. One of the previous interns was Jeff Smoyan.
Really?
Jeff Smoyan of MS Broadcasting. Many years later, when Jeff bought the Seattle Mariners, I wrote in a column the next day, Jeff Smoyan and I started out together. I only wish we'd ended up that way. So
I didn't know that about him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I did this, again, internship. That would be today's term. And I just stayed. And later that summer of 1968, they gave me an opportunity to go write a story, and it turned out okay, and they published it in the Star the next day. And then I just stayed in the sports department, and I got to do more and more and more. I saved up enough money. I got to Bloomington my junior year, finally, and left in 1971 and would have had – I had a job waiting on me. But I had a low lottery number, so I had to go play Army for a little bit in the reserves. It was not heavy lifting. In fact, I ended up at Fort Benjamin Harrison. They were teaching me journalism.
That yeah, because we went to the same. I was at Fort Benjamin Harrison when Dimpos. I was in the military.
Dimpos, yeah. Defense Information School.
So you got there when Knight got there?
I was covering.
Did you work at the IDS?
Yes, but this was
Indiana Daily
this
student.
Was pre-Knight. Knight came the next year, 72. Yeah, Lou Watson was the coach. At IU. So Knight came the next year. And do we want to do the whole Bob Knight thing?
Well, we can eventually.
We don't 45
want you,
minutes.
We don't want you to get in a bad mood so soon into the podcast.
Great mood.
What was it like covering sports then as opposed to at the end of your career? I know you were a reporter and then you ended up a columnist.
Right.
But is technology the biggest difference over the breadth of your career? Is it players' attitudes, people's attitude towards the media? Just kind of talk to me a little bit about changes.
Well, we all thought that sports would, especially professional sports, would eventually implode, fall on itself because of the cost. And I've been.
How can you possibly pay this guy $200,000?
How can you possibly pay when George McGinnis signed a contract for $100,000 or whatever it was? How can you possibly pay this guy that kind of money?
Or Namath. Remember, he did the $407,000 right. contract in the late to mid-60s, and everyone thought it was the end of the world.
So I've been waiting for the world of sports and the professional and commercial aspects of it to implode. It never has. It just keeps going.
Of course, how much did you pay for a ticket to the Pacers game in 1968?
$5.
My Van Halen ticket that I posted on Facebook, I think, for their concert in 79. I think it was $7.25 or $7.50.
So the attention that sports gets has never abated at all. It's only continue to build on itself and still continues to
the explosion of women's sports too.
No question. Title IX was has had a huge
Birch
impact.
Birch Bayh.
Mm-hmm. No question about it. But I was also fortunate, Robert, because I got, as Indianapolis grasped this thing called the Amateur Sports Capital and, you know, the sports initiative, I was fortunate enough to write about things that were taking place, the formation of the Sports Corp, the attraction of national governing bodies, the investment in infrastructure, Market Square Arena. Again, I was the beat writer for the Pacers when they built Market Square Arena. That was not without controversy when Dick Luger and my current associate, Jim Morris, decided to divert federal revenue sharing funds to help defray the cost of Market Square Arena. People were, wait, just like now. Hey, we got potholes. We got to plow the streets. We got to pick up the trash. What are you doing building this sports palace? Mm-hmm. But it was the first domino. It was the catalyst for everything that would come thereafter. The Pacers are hugely popular, playing in the Fairgrounds Coliseum, winning championships. They brought a hockey team along with it, and I've always like to tell people, oh yeah, that guy named Wayne Gretzky, he scored his first professional goal as a member of the Indianapolis Racers, and I was fortunate. But concerts, where did you first see Van Halen?
I was in the military, so okay. I saw it at El Paso.
Did you see him at Market Square?
By the time I saw him, they had moved to the field house, but obviously the Elvis concert is iconic. And you had told me something. You were the one who told me this, and I'd never heard it before, that Market Square Arena was built in 74. It was
74.
And they wanted to build it in Pike, the northwest part of town. Talk about that a little bit, because you're talking about a complete game changer.
No question. They were talking about near Lafayette Square, off of I-65. Near Lafayette Square was one of the proposed locations for an arena. But Dick Lugar, from his view in the 25th floor of the city-county building, did not look like looking out and seeing nothing, especially after the sun went down. And again, Indy at that time was Indy no place. We had the Indianapolis 500-mile race. We had the Pacers playing at the Fairgrounds Coliseum.
But the ABA was not considered the ABA equal of the NBA. Yeah, I mean, when the NBA has Chamberlain and Russell and Robertson.
We love the ABA. We love the Pacers because it gave us kind of that, it gave us a foothold. We can be big time in something.
NIU was in a down cycle in the 60s, clearly. Basketball.
Yeah, in basketball. So, yeah. So the migration of people, there was nothing to do. There were no restaurants, Robert. It was a boring, dull place.
I've told my kids, who are 18 and 15, but we, even when we didn't live downtown, which is where we currently live, I never went downtown when I was a kid except to see Dick the Bruiser. That was the only time I ever went downtown as a kid. There was nothing to eat. There was no place to stay. I mean, you can only go to the top of the circle in the city county building so many
Ayers.
Times.
You go look at the Christmas windows at Ayers.
That's right.
Or maybe to the tea room.
But as far as an attraction, event. And then, it was just a couple of weeks ago for the... and I'm making a temporal connection to this recording, but when the Big Ten football championship was here, and Mike Greenberg tweeted, the ESPN sports host, Indy is the best big game town in the country.
Right.
Now, that's unfathomable to people like Jim Morris or like a P.E. McAllister or like other people who've been around since the beginning, if you'd have told them ever many years ago.
So when you tell me, when we talk about looking back and where I am now, I do look back with a great sense of pride and the fact that I got to live it and experience it along with many, many others. But it's staggering when you think about it. I mean, when we did the Super Bowl, we did it so well and so uniquely, Indy style, that the NFL said, to all future cities, you're going to have to do it like they did it.
That's right. We talked about that with Mayor Ballard on a previous podcast, and then, we could have spent 40 minutes talking about how great Allison Melangdon is.
Yeah.
And obviously Mark Miles too, but it was not just them. It was the whole community. There was no Republican. There was no Democrat. Everybody wanted to show off Indianapolis in a way that had never been done before.
So I was the co-chair of the media relations committee. As we ramped up to actually staging the game that month before, I was working for the Horizon League. I was working for my good friend, Commissioner John LaCrone at the Horizon League. That became a full-time job. So it became my full-time volunteer job for about 4 or 5 weeks, right in the middle of basketball season when there was lots of stuff going on with my day job. But John said, it's for the good of the city. Go do it. And there were so many employers that did the same thing. Here's our greatest resource, our people. Take them, use them, and let them thrive and help showcase our city, and we did it.
If you had to name no coaches, Mount Rushmore ABA era Pacers.
Oh,
who'd you name?
Well, Roger Brown, George McGinnis, Slick.
No coaches.
No coaches. Sorry. All right, Roger Brown. Freddie Lewis would have to be on there.
Mel Daniels.
And Mel Daniels. There you go.
Those four.
Those four.
No Nettolicky?
No.
What about the bar?
Close, huh?
What about the restaurant? That's interesting. He seems
Nettos
to be just
in the
as,
Meadows.
Yeah. He seems to be just as friendly, famous for that. What was it like talk about, you've said this before at our lunches, dealing with the players and like walking in the locker room back then. People were smoking. Well, what was the atmosphere? It was so much more relaxed.
So there's a famous picture of me at Market Square Arena on the press row. It's actually a picture of Slick Leonard. But I'm in the background and I'm dragging on a cigarette. And so people bring this up all, yeah, I've seen that picture of you smoking a cigarette on Market Square Arena. And I said, yeah, well, you know what? You'd go in the locker room afterward and it'd be a cloud because all the players would be smoking as well. It was just there are no Victor Oladipo's types then, you know, totally into nutrition. The absolute
McGinnis was just strong.
George McGinnis, you know, I got to see him for the first time covering high schools when he was still in Washington.
Washington High School.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my Lord. But, yeah, George McGinnis never lifted a weight and was an absolute Adonis. And he's still then and now a wonderful, wonderful guy.
Did you ever get into a scrape?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
I'm not talking to you, or how can you ask me that question, or you never played the game, that kind of stuff. Yeah. How did you handle it? And was it ever legitimate? Do you ever think, I've never been there, Robert, with tenths of a second left to go trying to shoot free throws to win?
No question. There are any number of times when I picked up the paper the next day and went, boy, that was harsh. And that was probably unfair.
As a reporter or as a columnist or both?
Both. Slick and I, we had our moments. He didn't think I was pro-professional sports, and there was something to that. Again, while I was covering it, I was still thinking that, you know, how much they paid this money. They were raising ticket prices. They moved into the new arena. They had real monetary issues. And I was thinking, you can't foist all this off in the public. There's got to be some responsibility among ownership. And Slick is a loyal guy, and Slick took it personally when there was criticism, and he let me know it. And he let me know it in a public forum, too.
Really?
Billy, you're either for me or against me. You choose.
We'll get to Bobby Knight telling you that same thing. We're here. You're listening to Leaders and Legends. Robert Vain is your host. We're here with Bill Benner, a longtime sports figure and community figure here in Indianapolis. How tough was it, and did you ever... I'm a Miami Dolphins fan, and so all of the, you know, Dolphins had another horrid year, and absent one play against New England. So these sports writers are calling for people to be fired. How difficult was it for you to say, they got to get rid of George Irvin, they got to get rid of Slick Leonard, they got to get rid of Jim O'Brien, or just anyone? Or the Colts coach, or the Racers coach?
I mean... Criticism goes with the deal, and criticism and judgment goes with the deal. I will be candid with you, as I got later into my career and as I got ready to leave the newspaper, the cynicism and the skepticism that I exhibited became part of my life, my personality. I didn't necessarily like being me, and I certainly didn't like some of the things that I felt was my duty to write. That said, I don't think I was ever...
Did you ever write, so-and-so should be fired? It's time to move on.
Yeah. Bob Knight, for starters. I was more concerned with not what he was doing for the university, but what he was doing to the university. And being a Bob Knight critic at that time, especially early on, I kind of got on the other side of that fence early on when he was still winning championships and being Bob Knight. And, you know, in all fairness, and I've said this to you, if I had to pick one coach to win one game, especially with inferior talent, it'd be Bob Knight.
So let me ask you, I never saw
a guy get more out of his guys than he did.
Were you in the Omni in 84 when IU beat North Carolina with Jordan?
Yes, I was. Yes.
What was it like to cover? I remember watching it on TV, obviously. What was it like to cover for people who are not necessarily huge sports fans? 1984, I think it was Sweet 16.
Yep.
IU plays North Carolina. North Carolina Jordan, had four Worthy, first round draft Perkins. Picks on their team. Yeah. And IU's only first round draft pick on that team was a fellow named Uwe Blopp.
Yeah.
And North Carolina was consensus number one team in the country. They had this amazing talent. IU was in kind of a rebuilding year after the glory of the early 80s. Yeah. And Knight came up with some way to defeat Dean Smith again, just 3 years after beating him for the national championship in 1981.
That's right.
So with that kind of preface, can you remember enough about that game and what you wrote? And
yeah,
what you were feeling?
I mean, it was on deadline, so that's always a panic situation, but it was stunning. I mean, it was nobody outside of the Indiana locker room, including the media, would have given Indiana a chance. But, you know, we've talked about Dan Dockich holding down Michael Jordan, and Indiana played the perfect game. And Steve Alford was great, and Blop. I mean, it was a team beating, not to take anything away from Dean Smith. I got to know and really admire Dean Smith. But Knight that was a Knight win, an essential, just the essence of a Knight win. And then the next day, there was a between day.
Right, right.
Knight gave one of the best media sessions ever. I mean, he was Bob Knight when he could really open up and share and be the historian and be the really smart guy that he is. He was just amazing. And then, of course, they lost to Virginia in the next game. The other essence of Knight victory that I covered, and there were many, but the other one that comes to mind was when Indiana beat UNLV in New Orleans in 87.
That's the better game of the Syracuse UNLV.
I mean, they
triumvirate.
And again, you know, Indiana had a good team. I mean, I'm not taking anything away from it.
They were number one seed. They were
just on talent. I mean, you look at UNLV, go, oh my God, Stacey Augmon, Larry Johnson, all those guys, and how could Indiana possibly stay with them? And Indiana beat them at their own game. Indiana.
He was smart. His Knight's point was, if I tried to slow the game down in the 60s or 70s, they're going to score 90 and we're going to score 60.
They beat him at their own game.
Yeah, it was 97, 93 was the final score.
But the night before, I was down there with a lot of my Indiana friends, and we were at Bourbon Street at a
place,
2:30 or 3 in the morning. And all of a sudden we look up, and kind of weaving down the street, arm in arm, their arms wrapped around each other, are Lefty Driesell and Jerry Tarkanian. And I turned to my buddies and I said, I have a feeling that if Coach Knight is up right now, he's looking at game films, but he's not weaving down Bourbon Street, Advantage, Indiana.
When Smart, you're covering the game when Smart hits the shot. Yeah. So you're an IU grad, proud IU alum.
Yeah.
Are you rooting?
Because
you were a columnist by then, so I imagine there's some leeway as opposed to just being a reporter.
I always, it makes for a better story when the home team wins. Always makes for a better story when the home team wins. And so I rooted for a good story. I always rooted for a good story. Give me a good.
But it
didn't get any better than Keith Smart hit the last second shot to beat Syracuse.
But did it matter to you that it went in or not, personally?
It wouldn't have made my day. It wouldn't have ruined my day. It would have been a story that I had to write on deadline, and that's what you think about.
Did you ever root against a team you were covering? No. Not a hometown team, obviously, but IU plays Kentucky.
Well, you know, I covered a lot of Indiana-Purdue games, and so I would root for a good story.
Which there usually were.
And I had a great relationship with Katie, and by that time my relationship with Knight had deteriorated. But you root for a good column. That's what you root for.
And you've told me in at lunch and other conversations about the deterioration of this relationship. Is it just a simple matter of you're there to do a job?
Yep. Everybody.
So tell a story if you want.
Well, let me just say this. Everybody covering Indiana would come to the crossroads sooner or later. Even Bob Hamill, who's fabled Herald Telephone sports columnist and
Bloomington.
Close personal friend with Bob Knight. But every journalist would come to the crossroads. When I came to the crossroads, I chose not to go that way. Collins had a great, or excuse me, Knight had a great relationship with Bob Collins, the legendary sports columnist that I eventually succeeded when Bob's health deteriorated. And Knight would often call Collins to trying to get Collins to bring Benner in line.
And what and time frame are we talking good, about here?
We're early talking mid 80s to early 90s. Yeah.
You finally had just seen enough.
Yeah.
And be like, look, it's not worth it.
I mean, shoving the LSU guy in the trash can. And
well, how did we know he didn't deserve it?
Well, you know, I just became weary of covering the non-basketball stuff. Could I have done that better? Absolutely.
I'm assuming you read A Season on the Brink.
Sure.
What did you think when you read it? I read it so many times back when it first came out because I'm on the plane coming back and forth from the military, and so I'm reading it like crazy. As a matter of fact, very quickly, I was reading it in the airport one day, and this tall, rather handsome black guy walked by, and I looked up, and I go, I just got done reading about you. And Michael Jordan looked back at me and goes, I haven't read that book yet. Is it any good? I'm like, it's really good, and you play a part in it. And he goes, I'll definitely have to pick it up. He was 5 feet away from me just walking through the old Indianapolis airport. That's a time warp right there.
John Feinstein did a hell of a job. It was a great, and it was one of the first kind of inside tell-all books. And I admired John's moxie for not pulling any punches and writing and reporting what he saw and experienced. I mean, it was a hell of a book.
Did you learn anything? Or you're like, no, this is all the stuff I kind of already.
I didn't really feel like I was enlightened to that great of an extent.
There was a part of the book where it talks about a news conference, and this is the weeds, but I've always found it interesting, where Knight is teasing a former colleague of yours named Phil Richards.
Great guy.
Feinstein says in the book that Knight liked Phil Richards. So is that something that you guys, that you like tease him, Mr.
No.
Richards, about that?
No,
or did he come to the crossroads that you discussed and say, I'm going a different direction?
Phil Richards is, A, one of the most likable guys you'd ever want to meet. B, he's one of the best wordsmiths. In fact, from my time when I would go up to South Bend covering Notre Dame, you read the local papers, the South Bend Tribune, and I very humbly submit that I was the guy who came back to Indianapolis and said, we got to hire Phil Richards. He was that good and is that good and was a tremendous writer throughout his career. So he was covering Indiana as the beat writer when I was covering Indiana as a columnist.
So we'll do it. We'll head back. We're back with talking to Bill Benner, Leaders and Legends, presented by Veteran Strategies. Mount Rushmore of the IU players you covered, basketball. Oh.
Alford, of the ones I covered, boy, that's how do you whittle down?
So 70s, 80s, 90s, basically.
Alford, Buckner, not because he was the best player, but because I've never seen a leader like Buckner.
Your colleague these days,
Calbert Cheney. Mm-hmm. Boy, I'd like to put Mike Woodson on there.
You gonna leave off Isaiah Thomas?
But Isaiah was only there a year.
He was there 2 years.
2 years, okay.
He did accomplish something while he was there.
Yeah, I know. He won the national championship. In terms of athleticism and talent, sheer talent, yeah, you got to put Isaiah on there. But what about Scotty May, you know?
That's why it's difficult.
Scotty May. It's really – how about Ray Tolbert, Landon Turner, and that group? I'll tell you, that was a – Knight let that team finally loose.
The 81 team
finally let them loose. And I covered the regional in Dayton where they opened up with Maryland. And Maryland, again, had a – just on
– They had Buck Williams and Albert King. Is that right?
King, yeah.
And former NBA stars.
Just on talent alone, you're going, okay. And Indiana went in and just kicked – I think it was 93-63. They just kicked their butts. And that's when he went, holy crap. And then Indiana had the good fortune, although I don't think it would have mattered. They played the next week. The regional was in Bloomington.
Right.
And then they went to Philadelphia and
beat LSU and then beat North Carolina. Yeah. So it's early 80s. I'm going to get the year wrong necessarily. Maybe it's not 82 or 83. I'd have to look it up real quick. And someone walks to your desk and says, get ready. The Colts are moving from Baltimore to Indianapolis.
Well, I was actually...
Tell me about that day.
Yeah, I was in Seattle covering the Final Four. And... Tom Reitman, who later it was, he covered the Colts for some time, and he was just another really good sports writer. He called me in Seattle, or no, Tom. Let me correct that. Tom was in Seattle covering the Final Four because he was working for the news at the time. And Tom, we saw each other, and Tom said, "I just got a call from Indianapolis. The Colts, they packed up the vans last night, and they're moving." I went, "Holy crap!" You know, there had been, this was folly to build a football stadium without a team to play in it. What are you guys thinking? But Morris and the civic leaders at the time, were smart enough to build it as an expansion of the convention center. And serendipity was involved. They put Colts blue seats in there, not knowing that the Colts would ever be the team that might. And so they walk Bob Irsay into the stadium. He looks up and he sees all these Colts blue seats and going, you guys, you built this for me.
For those who don't know, the in the early 80s, Indianapolis built a domed stadium without a professional sports team to occupy
the first
it.
The first NFL game to be played there was the exhibition. Bears and the Bills. Yes. And then Notre Dame Purdue played the first college football game there. But what the Dome did, much like Market Square being the catalyst for downtown development, the Dome then made us a player with the NCAA. At a time when the NCAA had just expanded the tournament to 64 teams, there was a fledgling network called ESPN looking for programming. And all of a sudden, the NCAA basketball tournament, although big to Indiana, became a big to America event. And there was Indianapolis with the Dome Stadium. And much like the high school tournament outgrew Hinkle Fieldhouse and moved to Assembly Hall before we built Market Square Arena, the NCAA tournament quickly began to outgrow conventional arenas. And there we were, with Dome Stadium attached to a convention center. And so we began to host regionals, and then we hosted the 91 Final Four in Lucas – well, I started to say not mm-hmm. Lucas Oil, the Hoosier Dome, mm-hmm. which later became the RC Dome, 97. But we began to build up all these relationships with the NCAA. So in 97, shortly after we had hosted the second Final Four at the RCA Dome, the NCAA said, we're going to look about possibly relocating our headquarters. There were 50-some cities that applied for that. They cut it. They whittled the list to, I believe it was 12. Indianapolis was not on the final list.
Really?
But we had – there was a guy who was running the NCAA basketball tournament, Tom Jernstedt. And we had done – again, we had raised the bar for the Final Four, and everybody admitted that. And what the way we did with the downtown and – everything being convenient, by then the mall was up and going. And Tom Jernstedt, said, I think you ought to take a second look at Indianapolis. And so they did. And so then we were among the, quote-unquote, Final Four, along with Overland Park, Kansas, where the NCAA headquarters were, Denver and Dallas. And because of public-private partnership, the state donated the land and provided funds to help build the NCAA headquarters in White River State Park, and we got the NCAA. Then shortly after we got the NCAA, the NCAA said, in return for your faith and investment in us, we're going to award you a women's Final Four, a men's Final Four, the NCAA annual convention, and major NCAA national champions every year.
On a rotating basis,
and I think the agreement runs through 2032. So, and again, investment, faith, do the good. When you have an event, treat it like it's the best event ever. I tell people this story all the time. In 1994, I think it was, the Big Ten decided they wanted to have a women's basketball tournament. This is well in advance of the men's basketball tournament. They put out an RFP to all these Midwest cities. Nobody was interested in women's basketball in the mid-90s. Are you kidding me? Except Indianapolis said, you know what? We'll take it. We'll take the Big Ten Women's Tournament, and we'll treat it with the love and the respect and the marketing and the volunteers. We'll throw all of our resources at that like we would if it was a Final Four. Well, shortly thereafter, 5 years later, the Big Ten started a men's basketball tournament, And then shortly thereafter, when we built Conseco Fieldhouse, Banker's Life, downtown, the Big Ten said, you know what? Great relationships. We love their downtown. We know how they do things. We'll start to rotate between Chicago and Indy. And then after they rotated for a number of years, then they said, you know what? We're going to put it one place for 5 years. I was on the bid committee then because I was working for Visit Indy. We went to Chicago. Chicago presents a bid. Well, why should the Big Ten tournament stay here? Well, we're Chicago. It's the Big Ten headquarters. Yeah. We're Chicago. What about the women's tournament? Well, we're not going to do it at the United Center. We're going to put it out. There's this nice little arena out near O'Hare Airport. We'll put it out there. Indianapolis? Why? What about the women's tournament? We'll play at Bankers Life Fieldhouse, Conseco Fieldhouse. We'll treat it like we've always treated it, like it's a big-time event. We'll market it. We'll give you the volunteers. And that day, there were 22 administrators in the room, and 11 of them were women. And they were all nodding their heads, and we were all elbowing each other underneath our seats going, I think we're going to get it. We got it for 5 years. When the Big Ten started the football championship, they didn't even throw out an RFP. They said, Indy, we know how you do it. You got a great stadium, Lucas Oil. It's coming there. So it's not only the guts to invest in infrastructure, whether it was an auditorium or a world-class track and field stadium or Market Square Arena or the Dome or the Field House, now Lucas Oil, a velodrome, a world-class rowing course at Eagle Creek, the guts to invest in all those things, the guts to reach out and establish relationships with Big Ten, national governing bodies, the NCAA. It's all paid off beyond anybody's imagination.
You can't really, and I was a kid, right? And then I was in the military, but the impact of Bill Hudnut on this city is, unless you kind of live through it or made it a point to study it, there really is no one. I mean, he was mayor for 16 years, and that makes a difference, right? But,
right.
I mean, Boldness was his middle name. He just said, you know, when you're punching above your weight, right? When you're fighting Orlando and San Antonio and New York or whatever for conventions and stuff like that, and these events, you just simply have to be and do what Indianapolis is and does, and it's really remarkable how many people come here. Because when I worked for Mayor Ballard, you know, we'd be out and about, and he would hear all the time just how nice everyone is. Like, I'm glad you're here.
Right.
As opposed to Chicago or New York or someplace like, why are you here?
I always say Chicago throws its arm around events. We hug it. We hug them when they're here. Here's another example. I love this. There, for the 2021 NBA All-Star Game, I think there were 14 NBA cities interested. On the day the bids were due, 13 of those cities FedExed their bid materials. And one of them had Larry Bird drive an NBA All-Star themed IndyCar down five blocks of Madison Avenue and hand the bid to Commissioner Adam Silver. So that's how Indianapolis rolls.
That's exactly right.
That's a great example of how Indy rolls.
That's exactly right.
And we'll do it. And when we have the NBA All-Star game, we'll knock it out of the park. And when we have
the college football national championship.
People say, well, what's next? After we did the Super Bowl and then we had the Final Four, and the men's and women's Final Four, what's next? What's next? We're going to have the NBA All-Star game. We're going to have another men's Final Four within 2 months of each other. And then 7 months after that, we'll have the college football championship game. That's pretty amazing.
And that's someone I'd like to have on the Leaders and Legends podcast is Ryan Vaughn, who is singular talent.
Yep.
What I was going to ask you a question. I'm trying to figure out how to phrase it, but I'll just go out and say it. What was it like watching Butler in those national championship games as someone who's been involved in sports for decades here in this city to imagine that they're playing those two games, one of them right down the street?
Yep. Well, were you rooting? Yes. I was working for the Horizon League.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Rooting big time. In fact, I sat with John Lacrone, and we were...
Commissioner of the Horizon League, and
watched Butler. You know, I had the opportunity to watch Butler, and you knew that kid, coach, seemingly kid, Brad Stevens, was something special. I never seen a team score off of more inbounds plays after timeouts than Butler. He still does it with the Celtics. And so that Butler team was incredibly special. But even more so was the one the next year went back to the Final Four after it had become Butler and built up expectations and ended up in the championship game again. I mean, that team was less talented overall than the one that went to the Final Four in 2010. So yes, did I root? Heck yeah. It was those teams epitomized college athletes. They went to class the day of the championship game. They went to class when it was here in Indy. They went to class. Wow. It's pretty cool.
And it has become a phenomenon, along with raising Butler basketball ticket prices exponentially.
Well, again, working with the Horizon League, you know, then shortly thereafter, they leave for the Atlantic 10 and then end up in the Big East. And I'm good for them. I'm happy for Butler. But that was a blow to our league.
Going back a little bit, we touched on it. What was it like when you're like, we have a professional football team? Because, you know, at your age, you remember Unitas and you remember Marchetti and Raymond Berry and the Colts, and they won Super Bowl 5, I believe. And the Baltimore Colts are now going to be here playing professional football in Indianapolis. Just what was it like covering them maybe in the early years? Because they weren't very good. And then they kind of the big news they made a couple years later was they swung the trade for Dickerson. And that was kind of a bit of a game changer. Yeah. And then,
well, to be candid with you, I did not cover them much. We had John.
Just the thought from a sports.
Yeah, no. I mean, it was another sea change for Indy. I'm as Pacers. I got the Pacer shirt on, and I have as great an appreciation for the Pacers and their impact on the city of Indianapolis as much as anybody. But getting an NFL team that says to the world, we've arrived. You're really big time. So
in the NFL in the early 80s was clearly significant entity, but it was probably behind baseball at the time
ahead of the NBA.
That's right.
Certainly ahead of the NBA. Yeah.
And now, and I mean, football is just, I mean, the NFL is just, you know, it's the big gorilla. It just runs over everything.
Right. Yeah. But it was, it said to the world, you know, we've arrived and we're here to stay, but not any different than, you know, again, the ongoing longevity of the Pacers, getting the Pan Am Games, the Sports Festival, the NGBs, the World Championships that we had, you know, the NCAA relocation, all of that is part and parcel of that overarching strategy. That's again incredible.
As you got older, and you mentioned, and then last question before we go to the final segment is, sports journalism in general, is it better, worse, same?
Well, again, I don't want to sound like the old get off my lawn guy, but
that was going to be the original name of this podcast. Get off my lawn podcast.
I am so glad in retrospect. There were a number of circumstances that led to my departure in 2001, my voluntary departure. I didn't get kicked out the door, but things were changing and my attitude and my kids were growing up and I'd been gone enough. But what I didn't foresee in 2001 was how social media would impact sports journalism. And so I tell people that back in the day, I actually, even if you're on deadline, at least you let the game end before you passed any judgments, good or bad, harsh or praiseworthy or whatever. You had chance to, at least a little chance to put things in some kind of context and perspective. Today, if Andrew Luck throws an interception, a bad interception like he did this last week, and you're going, Andrew Luck, you idiot, what were you thinking? Who were you throwing to? And you're posting it on social media.
And people like me are checking Twitter every 30 seconds.
Yeah. So the snap judgment world today that social media has created, the drive to get hits, I'm glad. I'm really, really glad I'm not part of that. And I think it has changed sports journalism and not for the better. And the lack of the lack of institutional knowledge that media outlets, not just in Indianapolis, but around the country, have let go. And we just had an example recently with the local paper letting three guys go that have go way back with incredible institutional knowledge. That's too bad.
The final segment in every Leaders and Legend podcast, and we're here with Bill Benner, is called The Five Questions, which is stolen a little bit from Mr. Lipton, but not exactly the same questions. So, you ready?
Yep.
What was the name of your first car?
The actual call?
First car you ever owned.
Oh, the first car I ever owned was a Triumph Spitfire.
That's pretty sassy.
First one I ever owned. And I drove the crap out of it. It was not ready to be a muscle car. And I
did you have a name for it like you do for your red Corvette?
I did not have a name for it. No.
Shortly
thereafter, I had a beautiful powder blue Mustang convertible. Oh, man. It was nice.
Really nice. We didn't get to this part of your life, and I wish we had more time, or maybe we can do a part two, but Bill Benner is a dedicated, enthusiastic live music fan.
Yeah.
How many times have you seen the Moody Blues?
39, and I'm afraid the number isn't holding because they are they're old. I mean, Graham Edge, the drummer, I think is 75 or 76. John Lodge, the bassist, is 70 or 71. Justin Hayward, their lead vocalist, is 71, 72. They're old. Lodge and Justin Hayward are still touring individually. I don't know whether they're going to get back together as a group or not. Last time I saw them was a year ago summer in Dayton, Ohio. So I love the Moody Blues.
So the question is, what was the first concert?
Oh, Fairgrounds.
You've ever been to.
First Fairgrounds Coliseum, I think it was 1965, and it was Hermits and the Hollies. Yeah. Now, I also saw, shortly thereafter, I saw Jerry Lee Lewis at the Whiteland Barn. The Whiteland Barn used to get these.
The Whiteland Barn?
The Whiteland Barn used to get these incredible acts. And I saw Jerry Lee Lewis with the fifth of bourbon up on the piano and just banging away.
And his 11-year-old wife?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe.
What?
Let me just say they didn't card her on the way
they
in.
They did not. Exactly. No. I get it. If you could recommend any book to someone, book that you've read, which book would you recommend?
Oh, man. The Bible. The Bible. Yeah. Easy answer, huh?
It is an easy answer, yeah. But it doesn't mean that it's not the
maybe
right
not
answer.
Maybe not what you were thinking of.
No, nope, I'm surprised that we've only had a few more before.
I was always a huge fan of Dan Jenkins.
Sports writer for Sports Illustrated.
And highly irreverent. And he wrote this book, and it wouldn't play today because the language in it is absolutely unacceptable in today's culture. But he wrote a book called Semi-Tough.
Did it become the movie?
It became a movie, and they did a crap job with the movie. They just did a crap job with the movie. But I always loved the irreverence in Semi-Tough. Dead Solid Perfect was another one of his books. I grew up reading the Chip Hilton, Clara B. Sports. If you got a kid today, I put a Chip Hilton, Clara B. book in front of him.
If you could witness any event in history, which would you choose?
Oh, man.
Any event, any time period.
Any event. In any time. Well, I couldn't be on the moon with Armstrong, and could I? Would that wouldn't work. Would have to be something that I could actually witness, right? Any event.
I don't know. You can answer it any way you like. I mean, if you say I'd like to be in the room for the surrender of Appomattox, that doesn't mean you're participating. It just means you're in the room. So if you want to be in the lunar module looking out going, hey guys.
I would have loved to have been at Gettysburg for the Gettysburg Address.
It's November 19th, 1863. Yeah. And
I would have loved to have been here for VJ Day.
That's what Ballard, be here, or Ballard, mayor, former mayor
been
Greg Ballard.
In Indianapolis for VJ Day.
Former mayor Greg Ballard, when I asked him that question, he wanted to be on the USS Missouri for the signing ceremony.
That's a good one.
Surrender. If you could have dinner with anyone in the world right now, Who would you choose?
George Bush. George Bush.
George W.?
George W. Bush. Yeah.
Why him?
You know, I admire the guy. I'd like to talk to George Bush and talk to him about 9/11. I think that would be a fascinating, incredibly fascinating conversation to have. And I know he's spoken publicly about it many times, but I'd love to have lunch with George Bush and just ask him about that day and the aftermath.
Is that who Jim Kittle said? I can't remember, George W. Bush is a tremendous history buff as well. It'd be hard, or maybe I said that when I was asked that question by somebody.
I went to the 9/11 memorial this past February. It makes you proud. It makes you pissed off. It makes you love America. It makes you cry. Makes you inspired. And again, the role that he played in that, I'd love to sit down and have lunch with him and talk.
And he has absolutely, without a doubt, number one, the best ceremonial first pitch in the history of baseball. Have you ever seen it?
Yes.
The one at Yankee Stadium right after 9/11, right after where he 9/11. Throws that strike from the rubber, not from the base of the mound, from the rubber. We are very grateful for you for joining us, listening to Bill Benner. It's been a terrific time. You are a dear friend. Yes. I cannot say how much I love you and enjoy your presence and your friendship. Thank you very much for listening to Leaders and Legends, brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated. If you want to contact us about this program or our menu of public relations services, please send us an email at robert@veteranstrategies.com. That's robert@veteranstrategies.com.